I'd like to welcome everybody to tonight's class, and it's good to see such large numbers coming. And again, on behalf of all of us, I'd like to express our appreciation to Mr. Dunbar for the tremendous effort that he puts into these classes. So we start tonight then with a prayer being read.
ربنا وفقنا لأمرك العظيم وتخلق بخلقك الكريم والسلوك في منهجك القديم بفضلك القديم وجودك الأمين إنك أنت الرحيم إنك أنت الرحمن الرحيم بنده آستانش شوقی
How are you all coming along with your reading? Are you reviewing the exam, some of you? Shall we ask for a show of hands of who's reading the exam in the class? Oh, that's very hopeful. It's sometimes difficult to find time here at the World Center to be able to read very much at a time, especially from sacred texts. So you must all be dealing with the challenge of finding time and keeping your interest up. How many of you are trying to locate the themes, the list of themes that Shoghi Effendi set out for the Egon? A few of you? There's some hands halfway up. Nobody's hands is fully up. But I don't know how to interest you in that, but it's a very useful exercise, I assure you, to find out what's in the book. But maybe you feel like you need to read it again first, and then... But as you're reading along, without going looking for the themes, if you see some of them, if you review the themes before you start reading, then you'll have an idea where to look. And you can make notes on it. I'll give you the page numbers for the themes in a couple weeks' time, so you can compare them with your own page numbering. And any that you found that aren't on there, then I hope you'll tell me, because I keep adding. And there's a few on there that probably shouldn't be, and maybe if you look them up, you'll be able to edit your list. Now, actually, tonight I wanted to start off with some discussion about just a few little notes, observations on study of scripture in general. Can I have some volunteers to pass these out? Can you give me one of them, okay? Everyone have one? Have a couple? We'll read through some of this, and you may have some comments or questions you'd like to ask. So a few thoughts that were put together for this study guide and have been used in the course in the past. First, it says that the Igan has been described by Baha'u'llah in one of his tablets as the Sayyid-e Kutub, or the Lord of Books, the Prince of Books, the Lord of Books. Penetration of its inexhaustible meanings obviously remains a highly challenging and ongoing endeavor. The reading of the scriptures, Baha'u'llah clarifies in the Igan, is for no other purpose except to enable the reader to apprehend their meaning and unravel their innermost mysteries. Otherwise, reading without understanding is of no abiding profit to man. The understanding and comprehension of his words, he further affirms, are in no wise dependent upon human learning. They depend solely upon purity of heart, chastity of soul, and freedom of spirit. You have the appropriate page numberings from the American edition of the Igan as to where those quotations came from. Now, those of you that are familiar with the approach to religious learning and practices in the East will appreciate that the Quran was not generally translated into anything until recent centuries into Western languages. Certainly was never translated into Persian. And the Persians, who spoke and knew Persian but didn't generally speak and know Arabic, had their holy book in Arabic, and they would do their recitations in Arabic without really understanding what was going on. And Baha'u'llah is making the point here that reading without understanding is of no abiding profit to man. Now, we understand that in a general sense, but it had that very specific sense also of reading text just so that one would fulfill their religious obligation without any consideration for what that might mean or what significance it might bear for the individual reciting it. Sometimes I think we have to be careful in our obligatory prayers that we don't just also do them to fulfill the obligation and our mind is busy somewhere else while we're repeating the words of the prayer. Anything that we do repeatedly, we tend to fall into sometimes that pattern. And we have to be alert, Shogifini, so we have to be alert to keep the prayer at a level of consciousness where we ponder on its meanings and we explore its significances and we don't just do it habitually. The last part of this paragraph, this quotation about understanding and comprehension not being dependent upon human learning. In fact, in some sense, human learning or acquired learning is a veil for man to be able to understand the realities of the words of God, because usually the human learning comes loaded with all kinds of opinions and prejudices and limited points of view. Even if it's scientific in character, science is not something that's absolute, it's relative and constantly changes its framework of thinking and outlook. As long as we're aware of that, as long as we have the appropriate attitude towards the manifestation of God, then he commands us to acquire learning in all the various fields of arts and sciences, the whole spectrum of them. He doesn't say concentrate on one so you can make money at it. He says you should study them all. And that's something that remains a challenge to all of us. But then we're doing it because of the manifestation of God, and hopefully then we retain the proper sense of humility and wonder before creation, and don't let it become a veil or a source of pride in us that keeps us from being able to meditate and think about the scriptures in the proper way. He adds, of course, these three tremendous qualities of purity of heart, chastity of soul, and freedom of spirit. Do you have any comments or thoughts or ideas on this, please? Yeah. Freedom of spirit. Does someone know from the original? Does anyone have the Persian Igan here? Are you following? Someone brought it. It's helpful if somebody has it and can keep a pace with where we're looking for. But you have to cross-reference the numbering. I have one. Maybe I can bring it myself. Have it here. But you don't know where to find it. Yeah. Okay. We'll find out another time. Freedom of spirit. Well, do you have any thoughts about that? Freedom of spirit. An untrammeled spirit, a spirit that's not held in bondage perhaps by attachment to lower self or to the ways of the world or to its passions. The spirit is free to respond, so to speak. These are the kind of things that come to my mind. I don't know. Do you have a thought yourself about it? You have it? Lovely. That was pretty quick. I'm going to ask you again. Farogat? Farogat. Right. What other meanings does that have? Any other implications? Wings. You see, in the Aktas, it talks about the verses, the effect of the verses should be such as to give wings to the spirit. And I also think of that in the sense of freedom, you know? That the verses of God should uplift the soul. We've seen Shoghi Effendi's admonitions to read and reread this exalted text, indeed to master its essential content. In this process, we should not feel unduly discouraged if our grasp seems too limited, for the study of this book is a lifetime occupation. True progress in this regard is conditioned upon the progressive unfoldment of one's own inner state. Quote, the heart must needs therefore be cleansed from the idle sayings of men and sanctified from every earthly affection, so that it may discover the hidden meaning of divine inspiration and become the treasury of divine knowledge. The eminent Baha'i scholar Mirza Abul Fazl recounted to Ali Kuli Khan that he had read the Igan with the eye of the intellect 17 times through, and it had seemed to him a meaningless string of words. But later he had read it with the eye of faith and had found it the key with which he could unlock the secrets of all the sacred books of past religions. So there's a level of comprehension which, when combined with this prerequisite qualities for being able to penetrate or being able to explore the metaphysical world or to become aware of that world in oneself, because it's already in ourselves. There's no cessation of grace, Baha'u'llah affirms very clearly in this book. The grace and bounty and gifts of God constantly move in the soul or in the spirit of man. But the degree of consciousness that man has about it is limited because he is distracted or he is prejudiced and veiled by opinions and by earthly affections, qualities that are not beseeming of a free spirit, of a chaste soul, of a pure heart, and therefore is not able to completely conceive of what this is that's acting on us. Now at times we concentrate more appropriately, we focus, we direct ourselves in prayers at times, or when we're thinking about the text, and then we feel this flow of inspiration. Maybe we feel it rather than as a flow of inspiration, as a flow of emotion. It may stir us. In fact, Baha'u'llah says the essential connection of the heart produces these feelings. Abdu'l Baha says that the connection between the true one and the servant should be one of ecstatic emotion. It's something that should move us. And this is something about spiritual knowledge. It not only informs, but it uplifts, it stirs, it inspires. How can we get to that degree of perception where we begin to pick the fruits of these divine trees that have been planted here for us? We're told that the spiritual progress is dependent on very simple things. Baha'u'llah has emphasized those that are the foundation, and that is the obligatory prayer, use of obligatory prayer, and the fast. Two great pillars that sustain the spiritual life of man. They seem so simple, and yet he promises that we will progress spiritually through these two means. Now that means that the quality of those should be constantly a center or focus of attention. How can we fast more appropriately? How can we use the obligatory prayer to greater effect? Maybe we should be using other prayers to ask Baha'u'llah to help us say our obligatory prayers in the right way, to help us to penetrate their meanings, to lift the veils from our eyes, to burn away the attachments of the world, so that we can become aware of this breeze of divine inspiration that is wafting through our beings. It all sounds, at the beginning, I think, rather on the poetic side. But it's a science, and it's very exact, and the rewards of it are infinitely beyond anything we can think of and comprehend. And they constantly, the writings tell us these things in different ways. They affirm them in different manners, so that they might appeal to all kinds of people. They might catch us in one way, if not in another. And the investment that we place in time and in severing ourselves from attention to the things of the world, we have to have a moderation in that. I mean, we have to take care of our daily affairs, but to not be so absorbed in them that we can't quickly move to intense consideration of divine texts when we have them before us. That's the kind of thing that will give us these rewards that are promised there, and it will also equip us to be effective teachers of the faith. So he says, cleanse the heart of idle sayings and earthly affection. Then it may discover the hidden meaning of divine inspiration. Inspiration is, in a sense, is a breathing in. This is the breath of God. The spirit of faith, Abdu'l Baha says, is the breath of the Holy Spirit breathed in the soul of man. In other words, what in us constitutes faith is the very breath of the manifestation of God, the spiritual breeze or life that flows from him into the human soul. How can we become conscious of this? When we rejoice and we feel so excited to be Baha'is, we're in contact with that reality. How can we strengthen this? How can we reach a state of certitude with regard to it? This is what the Igaan is about. To awaken in us this awareness, this assurance of the role of the prophets of God in human history and in the individual relationship of God with man, to assist us to gain a clear insight into that, so that we can draw and tap on this inspiration that is within us all the time. And particularly when we focus the mirror of our being, of our mind, on a text, when it has those prerequisite spiritual qualities, then it will derive all of this energy from the text that's inherent there, waiting to be tapped, so to speak. Now notice Abu Faz talks about the eye of the intellect and the eye of faith in his distinction of the manners in which he's read the Igon. If you look up this source in Dawn over Mount Hira, you can read a lot more about Abu Faz, Mirza Abu Faz. There's some other accounts of him around too. It's very important to know something about him. He was considered the outstanding disciple, apostle of Baha'u'llah, really. The most erudite of all of his followers. Immerse yourselves in the ocean of my words, Baha'u'llah exhorts us, that ye may unravel its secrets and discover all the pearls of wisdom that lie hid in its depths. It's from the Akhtas. Abdu'l-Bahá counsels the student to investigate and study the Holy Scriptures word by word, so that you may attain knowledge of the mysteries hidden therein, and not be satisfied with words, but to seek to understand the spiritual meanings hidden in the heart of the words. And finally, Shoghi Effendi reassuringly affirms that the more we read the words, the more will the truth they contain be revealed to us. And likewise, in his own words, if you read the utterances of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá with selflessness and care and concentrate upon them, you will discover truths unknown to you before and will obtain insight into the problems that have baffled the great thinkers of the world. One note of caution, the truths of the Igon are best acquired within the context of its own wholeness and in the light of Baha'u'llah's other writings. We must never take one sentence in the teachings and isolate it from the rest. At the same time, we cannot divorce the spirit, the letter, from the spirit of the words. As Baha'u'llah says, we should take the outward significance and superimpose upon it the inner. Either without the other is wrong and defective. Well, there's a few principles here that we should be bearing in mind whatever we're reading of Baha'u'llah's writings. But particularly, I think, in the approach to the Igon, this is very, very useful advice. The verses throw light on the verses. The more we read and the more we compare between the various meanings and significances of the terms in Baha'u'llah's writings, from passage to passage, the more we'll gain an understanding of how he uses them. And that, and these degrees of receptivity, degrees of perception, gradually allowing us to penetrate into the mysteries, the hidden mysteries, as he says here, of these words, this is something that is a lifetime experience. It's a good place to start. You can go with your Igon into the shrine, and you can stand there and hold it next to your heart, and you can ask for some help, special help. You can do that anywhere in the world, of course, but I think this is a very opportune place to do it. Do you have any thoughts about that, or any points you'd like to make? You must have some thoughts about that. What have you found helpful as aids to concentrate when you're studying the writings? Do you think it's helpful to set aside a large amount of time, or do you find taking in small bits is better? Do you take notes while you're studying? Please. Read it out loud. That's a good bit of advice. Another one? Relax before, ask for help, concentrate. Good. Anyone else heard of or discussed? discovered some help for studying these texts? A good way to get through books when you don't have a lot of time. It also gives you something different to read every time. What about more concentrated study if you're trying to really come to grips with the book? Because this is one way, of course, with gleanings and so on. Time chart for the history. Yes. That's very helpful. One gradually can build up a gridiron, you know, something upon which you can hang all the various incidents that you've heard of in the faith. With history, it's especially true, I think. You need to have a time chart of some sort so you know, well, is this part of the first epoch of the heroic age, or is this part of the second epoch of the formative age, or where does it fit? How does it go? And gradually then when you hear things, you know where they connect with everything else. It's very easy. Yes. And Shoghi Effendi, of course, is the source for all that knowledge and information. It's really important. Please. Pretty great. You know, if you pray for an hour, you'll understand it in a different way. There's one thing about spiritual penetration of spiritual understanding is that you can't keep it unless you stay at that level. In other words, you may be in an elevated, concentrated mode, and you'll read the words of God and you'll gain certain insights, but they won't be intellectual insights, they'll be spiritual insights. And you can remember that you had a great evening the next night, but unless you can get to that level again, you won't experience it in the same way. And sometimes the reading of these verses, there is a live meaning, which if you're up to it, you get it. And if you're not up to it, you don't get it again. But you remember that it was there, and you know how sweet it was, and you can talk about it, but you can't just at will reproduce that feeling. Because it is the effect of that word. It's the reality of those words, which acts on the soul at the time, if there's receptivity. And this is the kind of, I think we grow in this. The other thing is, I find I think some of these things are like spiritual games, this question of taking notes, or noting down favorite passages so that you stay in the flow of it. You're using more senses. You're reading it out loud as you copy it down, for example. You're collecting passages on one particular theme, making a small compilation out of these. And that keeps you concentrated and focused. And gradually the spiritual influence of these words begins to act on you. You know? And Howard Colby Ives used to say, he was a great teacher of the faith. You've perhaps seen his book, Portals to Freedom. He said that that this, he thinks that the souls in this time, which is a particularly dark time, need a couple hours of study of divine texts in order to bring themselves up, to tone themselves, so to speak, to the point where they stay receptive to these truths. And of course, if you read sufficiently, it isn't the amount necessarily, it's the quality and intensity of your reading, and retain some of these thoughts, then as you're doing your other activities, you can reflect on them. Especially those of you that have physical labors to do. In between, there's some routine tasks that all of us do during the day, and the sweetness of these verses and things remain with us. You can reflect on them, you can think about them, you can explore them. And also is useful then is to memorize certain small and key passages. Another means of being able to carry the influence of these with you. And if you aren't good at memorization, and if you haven't had a chance to read the verses in the daily, you've got the greatest name, and you can always use that. And I know May Maxwell saying that the master had told her that she should light this greatest name and take the light of the greatest name and place it on the altar of her heart and let it always burn there and illumine her temple. And this is something by repetition of the greatest name, by communing with that hidden dimension of the greatest name, those spiritual qualities, that intensity of confirmation that comes from the name of Baha'u'llah and turning and focusing on Baha'u'llah, that will also help us in whatever we're doing, and it also will assist us to again appreciate and concentrate more appropriately on the verses when we read them, when we study them. Yes, I think this is true of all of us. There are certain passages which appeal to us, and I think this is, again, it has something to do with the various levels of comprehension. Not that there's a progression, you know, that we're moving through, and things will strike us in different ways at different times. The same passage will say, "I read this before, but it's like I've never read it." You know, look at this. How could I have missed that the last time? And then you read it again in another year, and you'll may have a different experience. Someone else was one of the sources of help, I think, in finding the key passages of the Yigong is to search through the Guardian's writings to see where he has quoted from the Yigong and what he's quoted from the Yigong. And perhaps the most important of those sources is the letter, The Dispensation of Baha'u'llah, written by Shoghi Effendi in 1934. This is a powerful exposition of the essential verities of the faith. And if you haven't, up to this time, studied it, you'll certainly want to put it on your list of things to do. It's a very good complement to the Yigong, and in fact it takes those most essential aspects of the doctrines of the Kitab-e-Yigong and cites them in Shoghi Effendi's argument. He brings them up. The relationship between God and His manifestations, principally. These passages I have extracted here to share with you. And they're not only the most basic of the Baha'i doctrines of the Yigong, but they're also the essence of the message of the Yigong, I think. There's something we'll want to consider and assimilate, and I'll share copies of this with you next week so you can have them. If you have you have copies of the Gan with you, I can give you some page numbers, or you can take notes to read them at home if you want. Shoghi Effendi, in putting together these passages, has skipped around. He's excerpted a bit here and a bit there to better illustrate the point that he's making in his own narrative. This first section is on God, the unknowable essence. And you'll remember in the list of themes and topics from the Gan that we looked at several weeks ago, the first point is that the Gan proclaims unequivocally the existence and oneness of a personal God, unknowable, inaccessible, the source of all revelation, eternal, omniscient, omnipresent, and almighty. These are Baha'u'llah's words from the Gan. This is page 98 and 99. There are a few interspersing words of the Guardian in these passages. He who in unnumbered passages claimed his utterance to be the voice of divinity, the call of God himself, thus solemnly affirms in the Kitab-i-Gan. To every discerning and illumined heart, it is evident that God, the unknowable essence, the divine being, is immeasurably exalted beyond every human attribute, such as corporeal existence, ascent and descent, egress and regress. He is and hath ever been veiled in the ancient eternity of his essence, and will remain in his reality everlastingly hidden from the sight of men. He standeth exalted beyond and above all separation and union, all proximity and remoteness. Then Baha'u'llah himself quotes from Islam, God was alone, there was none else beside him. And he states that this is a sure testimony of this truth. What do you think is the meaning of this phrase quoted from the Quran? God was alone and there was none else beside him. You have some idea about that? Mm-hmm. Exalted above all other created beings. There first. Okay. Any other thoughts? You might have thought of a tablet in the Gleanings that explains it. There is one which gives further insight on this. God was alone, there was none else beside him. He shall ever be what he has always been, he goes on to affirm. He will always be alone with nothing beside him. It's a state of his being. Then we realize that the world of creation, all the created realms, are a mere nothingness, a shadow, a semblance of reality. But in comparison with God, they're non-existent. This is a way, I think, of showing us the uniqueness of God, and also a bit of our own ephemeral character. Of course, there was none else beside him, in the sense there was none like him beside him. Unique, singular. The next thing that the Guardian treats is the appearance of the prophets of God. Now we have God, we're saying he's inaccessible, he's unknowable, completely out of touch, so to speak. Then Baha'u'llah affirms in this manner. He says, the doors of the knowledge of the Ancient of Days, and here the Ancient of Days refers to the Godhead. Baha'u'llah further states in the Kitab-i-Gan, being thus closed in the face of all beings, he, the source of infinite grace, hath caused those luminous gems of holiness to appear out of the realm of the spirit in the noble form of the human temple and be made manifest unto all men, that they may impart unto the world the mysteries of the unchangeable being and tell of the subtleties of his imperishable essence. All the prophets of God, his well-favored, his holy and chosen messengers, are without exception the bearers of his names and the embodiments of his attributes. These tabernacles of holiness, these primal mirrors which reflect the light of unfading glory, are but expressions of him who is the invisible of the invisibles. So we have that God, out of his love, has created instruments that are some, in some mysterious way, connected to his realm, or are channels or mediators of his power, and then he's ordained that they should come to be in the world of existence amongst his other creatures and be the source of knowledge of him. They're the same order physically that we are, in a sense, although even one of Baha'u'llah's tablets, he says, there's a lot of difference between dirt and diamonds, between dust and diamonds, and the manifestation's body, he said, is like a diamond. It's made of the same thing that we are, but it's somehow consolidated in a way. It's this focal point, even physically, of this tremendous divine power. And through his physical being come the words of God, spoken in a physical, material way, chanted in a physical, material way. So there's something extraordinary even about the atoms that have been in touch with such an exalted spirit. But he lives among men. He has a body like we do. He has an individual soul, although the nature of that soul is different from human souls, because we're told it has pre-existence. It has existed before it appeared in this world, in the spiritual world, and it returns there after its passing of the physical being of the manifestation. Yes. Let's see. I think it's in Lights of Guidance someplace, but it's also in the messages to Alaska, in the letters to individuals. It talks about the pre-existence of the soul of the manifestations. Particularly talks there, I think, about the pre-existence of Christ's soul. But he said, we cannot know what its condition was before it came here. We have no way of knowing what the condition of the soul of the prophets were in the divine world. I once was asking one of the Persian scholars of the faith a little bit about this, and he knew something of the writings of the Bab, and he told me a story. I'll tell it to you, but this is, you'll remember this is a pilgrim note, because I haven't seen it. I mean, I heard the Arabic text, but I don't know how well translated it is or transposed, but it's very interesting. He says that God gathered all the prophets of God, all the prophets and messengers in the heavenly realm, and he announced unto them that in the future of development, that Baha'u'llah, he was going to send Baha'u'llah, cause him to appear. And when he revealed something of the nature of Baha'u'llah, they all fell down immediately in acceptance. This is the Bab is recounting this. He says, except four of them that stood and blinked first, and then they fell down. And it says, God saw them, that they blinked before they fell down. And he noted their names, you know, so to speak. He took them into account, and he said during their services he has drawn them close to the fire, and they've been cleansed of their shortcoming in their complete submission to Baha'u'llah. And then he names them. Now, they were among the lesser prophets. One of them was Adam, who we already read had some difficulties. And another with Shoaib. And two more that in the state of being overcome by hearing this story, I didn't remember. Jonah, I don't know. Jonah, he had his problems too, I understand. But anyway, they all were true prophets of God, and we know that Adam was a prophet of God as well, in as affirmed by the Quran and the Baha'i writings. And in contrast to what we may understand about him from the Old Testament, we should bring our understanding of figures in the Old Testament into harmony with the way they are described in the Quran. For instance, Solomon is a manifestation of God in the Quran, but in the Old Testament you read stories about him that you wouldn't necessarily attribute to him divinity and prophethood and so on. Now he says these are tabernacles of holiness, primal. Reality of the manifestation of God. Now we were talking about the manifestation. We said he has a body, he has an individual soul, then he has a third reality. And that third reality is this effulgence of the Holy Spirit, the effulgence of the Son of Reality, this light of God. And that's a universal reality, and in the Quran, Baha'u'llah over and over in several spots emphasizes that this is one reality. So that if any of the manifestations says that they are another of the manifestations, the return of one or another, or the return of all of them, indeed it's true. Because it's this light that's speaking, in a sense. It's that birthright of the prophet of God, that he speaks with this power of God. And he's God incarnate, although we know there's no such thing. But he is the appearance of God amongst men. There's no other way to see God except through the manifestation of God. Yes. Yes. It's connected to them in an essential way. It isn't given to them at a later date. There's several passages that affirm that. Some of them you'll find in some answered questions. That's important to know. It's in one talk, the master says that it's like a man sleeping and then waking. You know, he's got all the power, but he's asleep. He's not using it. But then he wakes up. And when he wakes up, it's like when his mission began. I was asleep on a couch when, lo, the breeze of the All-Merciful wafted over me and I arose. This is Baha'u'llah's way of saying this thing, that this I is that universal power of God that was in him. He was living his life before that, but he wasn't revealing the words of God. But Abdul Baha says, if you look, you will see the perfections of God in them from the very beginning. So then you have stories about the childhood of the prophets and how they would amaze that occasionally this power of vision would show itself in some way and cause people to wonder about them. Now, this brings us to a point, another way of studying that's very helpful is to take the Quran, read the Quran, read some answered questions, and then cross-reference the two books so that you will have the notes in the margin of your Quran where there's a fuller explanation about this from Abdul Baha's talks in some answered questions. And also in some answered questions you'll have reference to where you can find in the Quran the passages that are being explained by him, because there's a lot of interaction between those two books. And also, if you take the themes of the Quran and you cross-reference them with the themes of prayers and meditations, it's a long study, it takes time, but it's well worth checking and seeing how the various doctrines of the Agon are revealed in the form of prayer. The station of God, the relation of God in the manifestation, the reason for the manifestation's appearance in the worlds of creation. All of this is in Prayers and Meditations as well. Prayers and Meditations is an extraordinary study book, which most of us ignore as a study book because we think of it as a prayer book. And we look for prayers that we like to read when we want to pray, and the rest of the time we say, well, that's not me, that's Baha'u'llah speaking there, I can't use that one. And we look for another prayer. Instead of reading them to see how he reveals his own nature, how he reveals his relationship with God through the words of his prayers and meditations. It's an extraordinary study, and I hope that sometime in the future we'll be able to have a class or a course on prayers and meditations from the point of view of studying it as a book of doctrine and history and essential verities of faith, rather than from the vantage point of being a book of prayers. Yes. You can find things there, yeah. This was one of these amazing portions, just right near the page that we're quoting from here, from the dispensation, about page 102, 103 of the Agon, where Baha'u'llah says, all things live and move and have their being through the manifestation of God. And again, you have this live, move, and have his being through God in one of the epistles, I think of Paul, it is in the New Testament. That brings us to this question of the all-encompassing character of the manifestation of God. The Bab affirms in his writings, and you'll find the details of it in the selections from the writings of the Bab, that the first reality that exists from God, the first emanation from God, is what was called in ancient times the first mind or the universal mind. That was the Greek term for it, nous. And this was carried through philosophers down through Islam and into the scholastic philosophers of the medieval period. This nous, Abdu'l-Bahá says, in Baha'i terminology, is the first will or the primal will, mashiat. The primal will, Mashiyati Avaliyeh, this all-encompassing universal reality, which is, Abdu'l-Bahá affirms in one of his tablets, the world of command, this middle realm of the ring stone. That is, it's a separate world from the world of creation. It is the matrix of the world of creation. The world of creation is woven within it and comes to exist within its influence. And everything that exists, exists through the primal will. Comes from it, returns to it. And then that primal will is reduced, in some of the writings, to a point. Everything comes out of the point. And that point, the Bab says, that's the manifestation of God. Now that point is the point of a pen as well, the supreme pen, which is the line of descent from God on high to the world of command, comes out of the point of the pen, and he says that all the variety of creation comes from this point, but also the substance of everything is one. You see, the ink is one thing, but by the movement of the pen, it is cast into various forms and significant entities, gives birth, if you will, to letters and words and sentences and paragraphs and books of meaning. But all from one point, everything flowing from that with a common substance. So likewise, we are made from a common substance. We are brought into being by this all-encompassing primal point, if you will, this universal reality. We are like fish within the covenant of Baha'u'llah, within the power of the manifestation of God. And the birthright of each of the manifestations of God is to possess this power, and through it to crystallize in the form of words and divine teachings the principles inherent in this higher nature that he possesses. That is the inner, if you will, essence and structure of these divine names and attributes of God that we witness in the manifestations of God. luminous gems of holiness to appear out of the realm of the spirit in the noble form of the human temple, be made manifest unto all men. Can you imagine from 1,000 years, every 1,000 years or so, one of these beings appears and then the people kill him? He comes and he has the capacity to completely transform and raise everyone out of their graves and send them to the highest heavens, and they are very suspicious about him and they kill him. What a history we have, really. Baha'u'llah talks about that in the early part of the Gaon. He said, if you just observe all of the trials and difficulties that the manifestations suffer, you'll immediately be confirmed in your faith. And the fact that they withstand these, they put up with all of this. The next section is on the power and sovereignty of the prophets. And this is pages 99 and 100, 97, 99 and 100, and 103. These quotes are coming from. They who are the luminaries of truth, or in this sense you could say of the true one, both means the same thing, and the mirrors reflecting the light of divine unity. And this divine unity is, again, he who is the divine unity, the essence of oneness, the universal reality. Baha'u'llah explains in the Kitab-i-Gan, in whatever age and cycle they are sent down from their invisible habitations of ancient glory unto this world to educate the souls of men and endue with grace all created things, are invariably endowed with an all-compelling power and invested with invincible sovereignty. These sanctified mirrors, these day springs of ancient glory, are one and all the exponents on earth of him who is the central orb of the universe. Here we have another title for God, the central orb of the universe. This is a mysterious one. Please. So we're saying, on the one hand, that we say all the prophets of God are equal, you shouldn't make any distinction between them. But on the other hand, each one came and did something better than the ones before, so to speak. How can we reconcile these two truths? Because they're both true. How can we do that? Somebody have an answer to that? Yes?
Read how glorious his revelation over all of them. they're talking about different things. One is the potential and the capacity of mankind, why the prophet decided to manifest.
Thoughts about that? Yes. Did you hear that? That it, because the manifestation doesn't manifest a particular attribute, doesn't mean that he didn't possess it. See? Mm-hmm. I've heard of the tablet. Aaron, do you want to say? Any other thoughts about that? Yeah.
The story you told earlier about before the
millennium,
that
shows that seems to, doesn't it? But again, and that's in their outer, still that's in their outer personality and nature. I think that the key probably to it, of course, it's the key to it is in the ego, and we'll get to those passages too. But all the prophets of God are the expressions of divine unity, of the divine being. And all could perform the functions of any other. Baha'u'llah says in one place, don't ask me where this time. He says that Christ and I are one. And that Christ could have revealed my mission, my teachings, but the people weren't prepared, perfectly equipped to do it. All the prophets of God could have been any of the other prophets of God. But they are each commissioned by God to reveal a certain measure of grace commensurate with the needs and necessities of the day that they appear. So from that point, they have the reservoir for the whole thing, but they teach according to the capacity of mankind. Just like a university professor can teach kindergarten and first grade. If he does, he doesn't teach the subjects that he knows for university. He's able to distinguish, he's able to deliver that which is necessary at that point in the development of creatures to carry them forward.
There's a question someone seemed to be asking.
ask you, why there seems to be not a difference in degree, not only a difference in degree, but a difference of type. You have the friend of God, you have the prophets, you have the spirit, you have the glory. Now, why is there this difference of type?
Maybe it has something to do because each has its distinct titles. It's another thing that it says in the Agon. Each has a distinct title. And that would be in connection and association with the power of the message he was commissioned to reveal, I should imagine. Do you have an idea about that? Can we compare this to the mission of Christ with the mission of Baha'u'llah? Can we compare the mission of Baha'u'llah with the mission of Noah, for example? You know, there is a distinction in the mission, tremendous distinction. Maybe you could think of it this way, that in an army, everybody's a soldier, but some are generals. Every soldier could be a general, perhaps, but there are some that are distinguished in a hierarchy for the purposes of the order of things. Now, I don't know, that's the way I think when I hear the title of the Bab as the monarch of God's messengers, the king of the prophets. Because he came at the consummation of a whole prophetic cycle. Chad,
I was kind of curious, you told that spirit flows through creation and is expressed in different ways. At one stage it's expressed as man, in another stage it's expressed as animal. And this is also a degree of change of spirit, but it expresses itself as a different quality, a different type. I wonder if the relationship between this and the different levels of expression and manifestation, a different level expresses itself as a different type almost, because of the pattern of I'm wondering if there is a similarity, what is that? What is causing that? What is the pattern behind that?
It's an interesting subject to wonder about. I don't know if I have an answer for it. I know that they're all the embodiments of the Holy Spirit, though. So, you know, whatever the limitations of their outward manifestation, inwardly they are the possessors of the same light. They are the inherent bearers of the primal will in the world of creation. And the world of creation doesn't mean just the physical world. It means all the spiritual realms where individualized reality souls dwell after death, or perhaps there are entities that have never been through the physical realm. We don't know too much about that. That was a question that's been asked. Are there other entities beside human beings and prophets in the spiritual realms? So I have to wait a while to figure that one out, find the answer. Any other thoughts on this? Please, sorry. They have to be angels. See. Well, it does, but he relates it to the planets, actually. He says that every fixed star hath its own planet, and every planet has its creatures whose numbers know. He talks also about creatures in, well, of course, there would be creatures in all the worlds of God, yes.
And in the next world, it would take on the form of God.
Yes. The best vehicle for your reality in that plane of existence. Please, Sky.
I mean, I'm a little bit off of the road now, but the Allah says in the thing that the essence of the oneness of God is to accept that the manifestation is actually God. It's the same. So, the manifestation is God. It's only an expression of the certain view.
Yes. It in a sense, they are the manifestation of God. You know, when you even think of the word, they manifest God in creation. And Baha'u'llah states that we can see it in two ways. We can see the manifestation as the appearance of God, or we can see him as the messenger of the laws and teachings of God. Both are acceptable unless we argue about them, he says, then they're not acceptable. In other words, there is a degree at which you tend to see more of the divine in the manifestation of God. First you think of him as a teacher and a messenger and a gardener, and later on you see that he's divinity itself. As far as the human soul is concerned, that's the highest degree they're going to have any access to. The tree beyond which there is no passing, the face of God amongst men. But the manifestations are also clear to say that they are not God, and that there is this other level beyond them, this invisible essence that they manifest. And also that they understand him only in terms of their own being. They don't ever penetrate the world of God. They understand God by the influence that God has in them and through them on the rest of creation. And by that they're able to define and understand something about God. But beyond them there's this veil also that nobody can penetrate. Not them nor anybody else. So that's the only appearance of God that we know. And even the name of the essence of God is beyond, is the nameless and placeless one. It specifically says in the writings that the meeting of God in the other world means the meeting of the manifestation of God, is the witnessing of the manifestation of God. But there, with many of his veils that he had here, the physical veil removed, so the splendor and the position of the manifestation there is evident, completely evident. But that's the most of God that we see in the worlds of creation. But that's the way God's designed it. That's what he's made that point of appearance so we could see him, so to speak. And yet we know that's just but a resemblance, you know, it's something, a step away, always a step away from that reality. But then, how can the relative be connected to the absolute without completely being shattered and overwhelmed? Even the people said in the presence of Baha'u'llah, some of them can hardly stand up, you know. The effect was so great on them just to be near the manifestation. I think that what we're talking about is, you know, is that they are the sons of truth. They are the expression of the Son of Truth in the spiritual world. So by their light we will see, by their warmth we will feel. It's this essential medium for existence. If the power of the Holy Spirit, even in this realm, he says, Abdu'l-Bahá says, were interrupted for even an instant, we would all expire. There would be nothing left to us. And he says, if we wouldn't even be able to think if it weren't for the power of the Holy Spirit. Although we don't identify it as such, it's the cause, it's by which we are able to rationalize and think. So perhaps in that realm we'll realize how much clearer we're connected with him. After all, it will be his kingdom and we will be his subjects. And he will rule over us. And this is the whole question of that he has something he's reserved for himself, and that's the heart of man. He says, you know, everything else you can have, but the heart of man is my kingdom, where I want to dwell. Now there's free will, I think, because you can pray there, you can choose to pray, so that seems to imply that there's free will. But the question is, free will, the purpose of free will is to choose the will of God. Now if you get into a relationship with God where you're constantly choosing his will, that's the fruition and highest expression of free will. But his will operates through you, but it's because you're choosing it. So this seems to be that's the element of choice. I don't know, this is the way I understand it. The Bab says free choice is is only legitimate if it chooses the will of God. If it chooses anything but the will of God, it's illicit. It's not there for you to make a choice between good and evil. It's there for you to choose good. And that's all its legitimate use it has. And any other use you put it to is not proper, you know. So in that sense, it would be its expression. Maybe it's the way we conceive of choice or free will. Does that explain something for you? Yeah. Perhaps, I don't know, this question of going backward and forward in the other world is an interesting one that I haven't resolved in my own self, and a number of people have been asking about it recently. If anybody can get a clear hang on it, let us know, let the rest of us know from the text what you find. There's a talk of the Master where he says that this soul only moves in a forward motion. But then he says it for this world too, but we know we can become pretty bad after we've been good. So maybe it means that the soul, the very nature of the soul, doesn't corrupt, but it becomes clouded and surrounded. It's like the mirror. The mirror is always a mirror, but it can be crudded up, you know, with 4 or 5 inches of mud, or it can be clean. If you get back to cleaning it, it's still there. I don't know. Maybe hell is just an accumulation of dross rather than an essential change in character of the soul. Be that as it may, the result is the same. You're completely loaded down and covered and unillumined and uninspired and all the rest of it. But these are subjects that we want to think about. I think it stirs us up and perhaps motivates us to act in a different way in this world when we think about it. Please, Dan. The velocity with which they're moving you appear to be going backwards. Among the passages, there are sometimes these punctuations of a certain character here in the Agon. Perhaps we could finish this evening with a paragraph on page 43. Baha'u'llah says, "O my brother, take thou the step of the Spirit, so that swift as the twinkling of an eye thou mayest flash through the wilds of remoteness and bereavement, attain the Rizwan of everlasting reunion, and in one breath commune with the heavenly spirits," capital S. "For with human feet thou canst never hope to traverse these immeasurable distances nor attain thy goal. Peace be upon him whom the light of truth guideth unto all truth, and who in the name of God standeth in the path of his cause.